Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. Stucker Yee here.
And I'm Gabby.
And welcome back to the podcast, my hoes. Welcome back, everyone. I know this one is a little bit late. We were actually supposed to do this one last week, and then I got sick and then made everything worse because I didn't go to the doctor.
Because he still doesn't have health insurance, you know, just a lot of stuff.
Okay, well, there's that. And I also had a whole bunch of other deadlines to meet, and I couldn't seem to justify sacrificing 30 minutes of my time to go down to the urgent care.
So he almost died of pneumonia. But you know what? He's alive. And we're going to talk about Daughter of the Samurai.
Exactly. We are back on this month's. Well, I guess it's this technically the previous month's, but it's right now. It's the Daughter of the Samurai. We're doing that immediately here. And then as soon as this little period is over, I got a whole series of videos that I'm going to be creating about this to go out to advertise for the book. Then it's going to be switching over to the next month's book. But either way, I feel bad about it because I was really excited specifically for this book because it's very unique. It's not one that we normally cover where it's like, oh, yes, great men in history, big geopolitical events and all this other stuff. It's way more down to earth. Because this is the story of Etsu Inagaki Sugimoto. And she is a woman who was born into a samurai family in the years after the Meiji Restoration in 1868. And in this autobiography, she talks about all of her different experiences, where she grew up in this culture that was very strict. It had very strict expectations of her. And as her family's influence and power begins to decline, she gets a marriage arranged for her and then has to leave to go and join her future husband in America. Which, that's where she then goes. Her story is filled with all different kinds of explanations of Japanese culture, religion, history. And as she's exposed to more parts of the world outside of Japan, she has to deal with all the differences between her own culture and the traditions that she grew up with. And those are the new place that, well, she now is her new homeland.
Okay, so you said this happens after the Meiji Restoration.
Yes.
So what is that?
That's actually the subject of what it is that I was going to be talking about today, because I realized that a lot of people probably aren't as aware of the detail. They may be going, oh, the Meiji Restoration, that's when the emperor took over Japan. That's what created modern Japan.
So does this fall before or after? It has to have been after isolationism. So
correct.
Where did the isolationist period end for Japan?
With the Meiji Restoration, 1868. And that's exactly why we're telling that exact story. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's what we're going to be doing. See, I love these first contact stories, and I love how it all develops. It's not always good. First contact developments are not necessarily always good, but things just tend to happen. There's actually a YouTube channel that I'm very fond of called Voices of the Past that is entirely like the primary sources of people meeting others for the first time. Like, oh, there's a whole sequence of a samurai's journey to America. And just like you get to see their whole delegation and them describing all the things that they're seeing and how like some of it's amazing, some of it's terrifying, and they don't know. It's so cool to look at. Anyway, I'm getting a bit off topic. That's why I like this. It's the same kind of thing. in order to understand the story of Daughter of the Samurai, people need to understand the stage that all of this is set in, just how much Japan was changing. As I said, this took place during the Meiji Restoration, and you were wondering what that is. Well, the Meiji Restoration immediately followed a period of, I'm going to just call it chaos. It was not a good time.
Did it follow the Sengoku Jidai, or did it follow a much later period?
Much later. But it's all kind of connected because it's one long, drawn-out thing leading to the next.
Because it went Sengoku Jidai, the Edo period.
Yes.
And then what?
Then the Meiji Restoration.
Okay. So after the Civil War, the time of peace, Meiji Restoration.
Yes.
Okay. So that should give everybody a good timeline of what we're looking at.
Yep. So we're going to go back into this, but 1850s and 60s are kind of chaos. The Tokugawa Shogunate, which is the ruling power during the Edo period, the era of peace, it had controlled Japan at this point for around 250, 260 years. A long time. It wasn't really able to do anything to protect the country. It just couldn't at this point. Outside interference was too strong and the country was too weak. But as for how that happens, the story of that goes a bit further back. And yes, I know that we're jumping back a lot, but this really is important so that people know what it is that they're dealing with and just how shocking all of these changes that occur are. So, after the Battle of Sekigahara in 1600, which I know
you went far back.
Yes, I know I went far back. I literally went back by 268 years. I know. This was the end, essentially, of the great period of civil war in Japan, the Sengoku Jidai. And at that time, the Tokugawa controlled around 30% of the land in Japan directly. And the rest of it was controlled by 270 odd sets of hereditary daimyo families. They were the feudal lords. The warrior government that the Tokugawa established was something called the Bakufu. And the lands that the daimyo controlled were called the Han. So this system that they had was called then the Bakuhan. That's what it was. Although the Tokugawa did put in a whole bunch of different policies in place to try and control the daimyo, and it worked within their own Han, these guys at first could pretty much still govern themselves as they pleased. Most Han were pretty small. They weren't powerful on their own, and they weren't able to wage war to conquer more territory. But some of them that were on the outskirts, like the Satsuma, the Choshu clan, and others, they were actually pretty large. It was almost like a miniature country inside of Japan. And so as time goes forward, in the 17th century, the Tokugawa start taking various different actions to try and control the daimyo and restrict them. From the beginning of the 18th century, the system stays in place pretty much because that's the way that it is. No one is really challenging it at this point. And the system, this feudal system that they developed, despite having the name feudal, was still remarkably, remarkably peaceful. And the economy expanded, the population grew, the cities developed, literacy spread everywhere. And it also started to see a new rising urban culture. What ended up happening in order to make all of this possible is that in the 1630s, one of the measures that the Tokugawa put in place on all these free daimyo that were, well, I mean, we use the term free, it wasn't exactly free, is that they tried to first restrict contact with any foreign countries through a policy of national isolation, which is the thing we were talking about, the period of isolation. No one could, like, none of these little clans, none of these other people, you were not allowed to have contact with foreigners.
What happened if you did?
Well, I'll give you this as an example. If a foreigner washed up on the shore of Japan, they could be executed. Yeah. Well, that's what would happen. It's what they would do. And in addition to that, the only places that you could actually trade with the outside world was through the Dutch at Nagasaki.
So why did they trade with the Dutch?
Because the Dutch, okay, there's a whole issue going here in the
beginning. I just want to know, of all the people they found trustworthy, why the Dutch?
So the first ones to actually trade with the Japanese were the Portuguese. and the Portuguese were Catholic, right? And one of the things that they had been doing was trying to convert a lot of different people. They were evangelizing, and they did. And it's funny. It's a really funny story with that. At first, since this is the 1500s, they're going around and telling the Japanese, oh, yeah, no, Christianity, it's this huge religion. We're all subservient to the Pope. Everyone in Christian Europe is Catholic. They're like, that's what they are. That's what they do. Completely ignoring the whole Protestant Reformation and everything else that was happening, like it didn't exist. So Japan's only knowledge of the outside world at that time, really, for like Europe and the wider world, came specifically from the Catholic missionaries. So when the English show up there later and they're like, oh, yeah, hey, we're Christian. Oh, you're Catholic. No, we're not. What the hell are you talking about? We're Protestant. What's a Protestant? And then they get.
Wait, so Christian. OK, what?
Yeah, I know. So they get called. I can't remember what the exact meeting was, but there was like this missionary and this English captain, and they're called before. Was it Lord Oda? Was it Oda or Toka? It was one of the big great unifiers, right? They call him before into this meeting and basically get grilled with the missionary who's been like a key advisor or like person providing insight, being like, why didn't you tell me about all the stuff that was going on in the outside world? Why did you give me the impression that the only Christian religion was Catholic? Well, because it's not a real religion, these Protestant heretics. And like, you know exactly how it develops.
I can see missionaries lying.
Yeah.
To make their, you know, if somebody doesn't know, you go, oh yeah, we're the coolest of the cool. Honestly, yeah. Everybody listens to us.
So there was a lot of competition between Protestant missionaries and Catholic missionaries for like trying to convert people. And Japan didn't want conversion, especially after they had a couple of religious uprisings that ended up occurring. So they banned Christianity and they kicked out all the foreigners. Except for the Dutch, because the Dutch, their variant of Christianity was like Calvinist, you could say. And Calvinism within Christianity has more of an idea. And I'm going to speak in very broad terms for anyone listening here. There is a much greater idea of predestination, where from the time that you're born, you're either destined to go to hell or heaven. Like, because that's what you were always meant for, based.
So they didn't spend time converting.
So there was
people.
No point in converting anyone.
Super chill. That's super chill.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons why the Dutch made actually really good like business partners for people that normally there would be religious hostilities with. Because their response was, they're going to go to hell anyway. We're making money.
That is so self-serving. But also they mind their business. So I cannot judge too much.
I know, right? So it's just one of those funny things. And again, I'm speaking in very general terms about it, but that is pretty much the way that it was. So isolation, they cut things off. Then because the Tokugawa government feared that any daimyo might get a little bit rebellious, they also cut off contact with most places, including like Korea and others. Like Korea, China, all of the Europeans, everyone except the Dutch pretty much were excluded. The Tokugawa were able to adopt this policy because Japan was a far from Europe, and also because the technology that existed at this time, though there was technically superiority on the part of the Europeans, it wasn't to such a degree that it would make that vast of a difference in the event of an armed conflict. So, fast forward a bit of time. And at the end of the 18th century, Europe is changing rapidly. They're experiencing the Industrial Revolution. And at the beginning of the 19th century, European ships that are armed with big industrial age weapons start to approach Japan, demanding that the country open up to foreign trade. And the Tokugawa are like, no, screw you guys. We're not going to do that. We don't want that. But here's the problem. Europeans didn't exactly like taking no for an answer in many places. And when places like China refused them, well, it didn't go down well. By 1839, Britain had already colonized India. China was defeated in the Opium War, which was 1839 to 42. And this caused a panic in the Japanese government that, oh my God, we are really behind. the country is under threat. What are we going to do? So in response, both the Bakufu and some of the larger daimyos that could, perhaps through smuggling or some other alternative means, they made efforts to try and start acquiring European weapons. So, okay, they're starting to become aware of their situation. Good. Problem is, it's a little too late, because only a short while later, the Americans would show up.
Hey everyone, Sakuya here, and before we get back to the show, I would just like to thank today's sponsor, eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure that your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww. Yeah.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
So in the year 1853, the American commander by the name of Matthew Perry shows up and he sails up with a fleet of black ships, as they're called. The reason why they're called black ships, and I kind of like this little detail, is because they are steamships that are powered by coal. And because of this, they're generating huge amounts of soot and ash that are just billowing up into the air. And so to the Japanese that are seeing this, this is terrifying and new. And they demand to the Japanese that they open up their ports for trade. The Bakufu felt that from the show force that the Americans demonstrated that they were compelled to make some concessions. And in 1854, it agreed to the Japanese-U.S. Treaty of Peace and Amity, which opened the ports of Shimoda and Hakodate to American ships. Similar agreements would soon follow with Britain, Russia, and Netherlands, as the powers would see, like, oh, wait, Japan is opening up? Pounce. And then they would go after it because they wanted to do the exact same thing. The funny thing is, the reason why Japan avoided this trouble for the longest time is because Japan, despite its size, is not actually very high in natural resources and simultaneously does not have the fine goods to be produced in the large amounts, like, you know, the tea, the silk, the porcelain, the everything that China has. Japan, the reason why the Americans wanted them to open up their port was to A, trade American goods with them, and B, because they wanted a place where they could resupply on coal before going over to China.
Okay, so I understand they wanted coal and they wanted to sell them American goods, but just imagine you go to another country and demand that they open up their ports. How do you think that conversation went down?
Oh, it was forceful. In fact, there's actually one of the funny little details about this. The way it went down is Matthew Perry steps off the boat with the two biggest African-American soldiers that he can standing directly behind him.
Why?
To intimidate them. And it works.
Okay, but
you're looking at me like what? What are you? Yeah. Yeah. The entire reason here, you have to understand this.
Gabby, think it's cool. I think we have very different perspectives on it right now.
Any foreigner that showed up in Japan was just outright executed.
Yeah. Right? You said that before.
They had cut off all contact. Japan is a huge archipelago that encompasses everything off the coast of China, right? For any trade, if you are trying to get from the Americas heading over to China, the only landmass that is in between all of that and the Americas is Japan. It is the only proper resupply point that you could have. So if you didn't have enough goods, if you didn't have enough fuel, food, anything, while you were traveling, you could run into some serious issues. Like, it's completely understandable as to why people would want it to trade. And also, they were greedy and also wanted it to. All right, there are logical reasons of like, hey, we need this because we actually need this. And also reasons because, screw you, we want this. You're going to trade with us and you're going to damn well like it.
What was their plan if Japan just said no?
Oh, well, the way that they threatened them in the first place is that after they initially refused, Commodore ended up firing off a salvo into, like, basically the Japanese countryside, like, into the cannon, like a barrage of cannon fire. So basically Wang's like, oh, okay, hey, what was it, like, see that mountain over there? Check back tomorrow.
Sorry, this is the coolest part of this story so far.
And then the next day, they're like,
cool, I mean, unhinged.
And then the next day, they were like, okay, we'll trade with you.
Yeah, I don't know. Because, I mean, Japan had no cannons, right? They didn't have giant ships.
Nothing that could work like that. You know what?
Because I know they had guns. We went over that in the YouTube video, but
yeah,
no
and they
cannons.
Would import some too, but not nearly to the same degree that they have. And nothing as advanced as the naval guns that were on these ships. Not even close. Not even close.
Okay, so America strong arms, gets them to open their ports. All of the other countries come in, gets them to trade also. And they just have to sign it?
They just have to sign it. Like, there's nothing they can really do.
How does that look to the Japanese people?
Horrible.
Oh. They're going to say, oh, we're not strong enough to defend ourselves. Personally, I would not let that slide if I were one of the citizens.
Neither did the majority of people. The thing is, this did nothing but expose the weakness of the Tokugawa government. And its opponents accused it of failing to defend the country, becoming vultures circling a corpse. And so who do they turn to when everything seems to start going south? The emperor. Here's the thing that a lot of people may not really understand about stuff with Japanese history. The emperor of Japan has reigned the entire time throughout Japanese history. But there have been very few times where the Japanese emperor actually exercised real political power. In ancient times, the power was mostly in the hands of court aristocracy, and then later, it was in the hands of these powerful warrior families out in the countryside. The families like the Minamoto, like the Tokugawa, like the Oda, all these different clans that we were talking about before. So the imperial family always existed, and everyone was subservient to it. But they weren't really subservient to it. The emperor didn't really have any power that was backing them. And that was true as well in the Edo period, because Tokugawa Ieyasu, the guy who had found the Tokugawa shogunate, he didn't just create the Tokugawa shogunate. No. He had the emperor that he was protecting appoint him as the shogun, as the general leader of Japan in 1603. So yeah. He had him appointed as that, and that gave him the right to establish the government. So, of course, the imperial family has no real power. It was completely dependent on the Bakufu for everything, for its survival. And it was in the interest of the Tokugawa to still continue the imperial family and build its prestige and its image, because that in turn would give greater legitimacy to the Bakufu. The only reason why the Bakufu was allowed to exist was, theoretically, because the emperor allowed it. Which the emperor had to allow it. Until now. That's where things begin to change. Because over the years, starting around the 18th century, the imperial family starts to get greater influence and power in the minds of people, because Neo-Confucian ideas start to filter from China into Japan. And with this, you get some of the same ideas of the filial loyalty and family but also more of the idea of the emperor as a divine being that is of the gods, that is the rightful emperor. And that not only is the rightful emperor, but there was always this dynamic where China is, of course, the empire. And yes, you have an emperor of Japan, but it's like the little brother of China, just like Korea. They're starting to get some ideas at this time that's like, no. We're not the little brother to China. Our nation is just as great. We have an emperor is what we have. Our emperor is just as good, if not better, than the Chinese Empire.
How did they legitimize that in the religion, though? Because, well, you said it was Confucianist.
Neo-Confucian is more, it's not exactly religion. It's somewhat religion, but it's more so political and social cultural thought at this time. Because it's Neo-Confucian thought mixed in then with Shinto Buddhist religion.
Okay, but you said it was coming from
China.
Well, yeah, but you were saying it was coming from their relationship with the gods and everything.
Oh, yes, because within the Shinto religions, like the chief, the gods within Shinto, the native Japanese faith, that the emperor is the direct descendant of.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. How are they having both emperors be the direct descendant of the sun? That's what I'm asking.
Oh, no, that the Chinese emperor wasn't. That their emperor actually was. Their emperor over there might be the son of heaven or the will of heaven, but ours is a literal god. So
China's is a literal god.
No.
Japan's is a literal god.
Japan, yeah.
But China was bigger.
Yeah.
How are they justifying this?
Because we're better than you, screw you.
But also Chinese emperor was around much longer, right? But he's just...
No.
So they were at the same time, roughly?
The longest continuing monarchy in history is Japan.
Because they still continue to this day.
Yeah, the family that is on the throne for the Japanese, it has been around since like the 7th century AD.
I don't mean in general, though. I meant like, you know, because China was bigger and they obviously had like the bigger, more legitimized emperor.
Yes.
The fact that they would swing out and be like, oh no, he's just a son of heaven. We have it. I was just wondering their train of thought in the religion and philosophical scope.
Here's the greatest philosophical argument that you could ever ask for, Gabby.
We're better than you.
Nani,
screw
nani,
you.
Boo-boo. We're better than you. Suck it.
Okay, perfect.
And that is pretty much how things would develop. That thought, which started out pretty weak, would only get stronger as time would go on. Because all of this was disturbed by the Europeans coming in and making the Japanese really reevaluate themselves and going, oh, crap, we are falling behind. Because, okay. I do need to touch upon where a lot of these ideas came from. During the Edo period, when we're talking about the samurai and the daimyo and all these different positions within society, people were divided into different categories based off their family connection to the Tokugawa, right? How close you were to the Tokugawa, how loyal you were, how long you had been with them, the better off you were in the beginning. Those who had been Tokugawa retainers before the Battle of Sekigahara, the ones who had thrown in their lot with them before this, because that was the deciding battle that determined who was going to control Japan. Well, they were the loyal ones. They were the ones who helped them get that victory. So those were the Fudai daimyo. Those were the ones who were going to get the best land, closest to where the capital was, the richest valleys with the best farmland. They were the ones who would be rewarded. Meanwhile, the ones who did not side with the Tokugawa, the ones who had fought against them, or maybe even worse, stayed neutral, these were called the Tozama Daimyo. They were less trusted. They were the ones whose territories were more out on, not exactly the frontier, but it was way further away from the capital. They tended to be larger and more on the countryside. They wouldn't have access to nearly as much political clout because, again, how far they were away from the capital.
I love how you just said political clout.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, political power, political sway, clout.
Because to be fair, none of them technically have political power at this point. It is more clout because they have to use their familial influence and everything. And it's their clout within the Tokugawa government or relationship with them that gives them any kind of authority at all.
Just nepotism.
Oh, yeah. No, we're talking about a feudal society. Of course it's nepotism. Of course it is. You kidding me? So it's in the 19th century that the anti-Tokugawa movement largely starts to develop in these areas that are controlled by the Tozama daimyo. The big ones that we would see for these names, and I love that I recognize these. When I'm doing the research for this and I'm seeing all this, I love that I recognize from the very beginning because of the there's a Total War game by the name of Fall of the Samurai, which is, to this day, anyone who has not played it, one of the best Total War games ever created. It is awesome. I love it. In it, you have the clans that are mentioned here. The Choshu, which is in the modern day Yamaguchi province. That's actually where I studied abroad in Japan. So I saw the statues and all the other stuff they had there. You had the Choshu, you had the Satsuma, you had the Hizen, and you had the Tosa clans. And these are all in the game. And it's really cool. But either way, I'm getting a little distracted and ahead of myself because I'm remembering some very fun memories of playing this. The last decade of the Edo period is something that is referred to as the Bakumatsu period. Baku, of course, coming from the Bakufu, and Matsu meaning the end. So it was the end of the government, the end of the Bakufu. In 1858, the Bakufu signed the Japanese-U.S. Treaty of Amity and Commerce, and this was a very unequal treaty. This wasn't just a matter of, hey, open up and trade with us. It was something that specifically I'm not even phrasing this right. It specifically favored the Americans heavily. We're talking like it caused them to set a very low tariff on any imported goods, so they couldn't really charge anything when the Americans would be able to then flood the markets with their own goods. That in turn meant that any of these goods that were coming in would outcompete the local Japanese retailers. So if like you had someone who was making cloth by hand and they had been producing cloth in this way for generations, now all of a sudden the Americans show up after spinning out, you know, 1,000 yards in a factory that they just produced, and they're able to sell it for pennies on the dollar. Well, there's no way that the Japanese business could compete. It's gone. They Walmarted Japan.
They didn't think that that could negatively impact society.
They knew that it would. They had no choice.
No. The Americans.
Oh, they didn't care. They were making money.
Awesome.
Gabby, this is the 1800s. It's screw people over, get money, honey. That's what we do. That's the world, baby.
Awesome. Sorry, I just have a conscience, and I guess I'm looking at it from a modern perspective.
Very good. It's understandable to be looking at it from a modern perspective. These guys didn't give a shit. That's how the world works. So yeah, they would drown out things here in the Japanese economy, and also simultaneously what they did is that they pretty much made it so that the Americans that were there were immune to Japanese laws. Not that they were immune, but if they committed a crime, like let's say that an American got in a dispute with someone at a bar and, you know, beat him over the head with a bottle and it killed him or something. Well, that American could not then be charged in a Japanese court. They had to be sent back to America to be charged.
And they agreed to this.
They had to.
Why did they have to? They could just say, hey, I will sign this, but let's just change a few things.
No. Big booby guns.
That's fair.
Yeah, exactly. So this just created a lot of hostility towards foreigners. And among those advocating for the overthrow of the Tokugawa were a group of people that referred to as the Shishi, or the Righteous Warriors. These were extremists who would carry out violent attacks on foreigners and also Japanese people that they thought were now enemies of the state because they're siding with the foreigners. That movement would get cracked down on, but over the years, the sentiment would just grow and grow and grow until things would finally boil over into the Boshin War. Now, if I'm going to be talking in detail about all these events, we're never going to get done. This is going to go on forever. This is a lot that we are talking about. So I personally don't think that my voice could handle it. I will go into a coughing fit if I go that far, because I'm still not 100% recovered. The gist of the Boshin War is that an alliance of southern samurai, particularly from the domains of Choshu and Satsuma, and a number of court officials, all teamed up to take control of the imperial court and influence the young emperor Meiji. So Tokugawa Yoshinobu, who was the sitting shogun, the guy who was in charge, he realized he was screwed. There was nothing that he could do against this. So he thought that he could potentially save his position by abdicating political power to the emperor. He hoped that this would work and allow him to participate in the government in the future. But when imperial forces started launching different military movements, partisan violence broke out in Edo, and then an imperial decree that was promoted by the Satsuma and Choshu abolished the House of Tokugawa. Well, this led to him then having to turn around and launch a military campaign to try and seize back the emperor's court at Kyoto. The military tide would very rapidly turn in favor of the smaller force of the Imperials, but the funny thing is they had actually relatively modernized themselves with weapons. They had gone and purchased a number of foreign modern weapons to be able to be used for the battle. They ended up beating them in a series of victories. Yoshinobu personally then surrendered, and those who were still loyal to the Tokugawa ended up retreating to northern Honshu and later to Hokkaido, where they would found the Ezo Republic, which was a very short-lived separate government that was then defeated only like a year later or so, which resulted in the completion of the Meiji Restoration, military-wise. Now, it's actually pretty funny because, Gabby, do you know what the phrase of Japan was? Or, sorry, Japan. The imperial forces during the time that they launched this whole rebellion to take out the Tokugawa was?
No clue.
Revere the emperor, expel the barbarian. The barbarian was not Tokugawa. It was expel all foreigners.
Okay, I was so confused. But they were fighting the Tokugawa.
Yeah, of course.
Because they allowed the foreigners in.
Yes.
Okay, that checks
out. So it was revere the emperor, expel the barbarian. But it's really ironic because they called for the removal of all things foreign, but then immediately did the opposite.
What did they do?
Well, because in order to defeat the barbarian, they realized that they would have to become like the barbarian, at least in terms of military, technology, and politics to a degree. Drastic changes were going to be needed by the state if it was going to survive its first few years, unless it was just going to descend into a civil war immediately after, and then possibly get turned into a colony by another foreign power. They would have to change and adapt. So, in 1871, the recently established Meiji government then tried to stave off this feared collapse of its authority by abolishing Japan's domain system. So, all that land that was in the ownership of those Han clans before, gone, wiped. Each one of these clans, these 270 daimyo, they had their own military forces and political wills within a decentralized power structure. They wiped that by removing it and consolidating everything into their prefecture system, which Japan still has to this day. That in turn meant that they had effectively wiped out all local political power. The Meiji leaders also resolved the issue that their government had to be the sole political power in the land in order to be able to exercise the creation of a modern state so that another power like the Satsuma or the Choshu or another clan didn't do the exact same thing to them that they did to the Tokugawa. They needed to remove the entire thing. See, their deepest concern about all this is that if they weaken themselves too much, that Japan was going to end up just becoming a colony under the control of one of the other great powers. That was what had happened to Southeast Asia. That is what happened to China, to India. Well, I mean, China wasn't a full colony at this time, but it had lost already multiple times and had been humiliated and was started to be carved up into different spheres of influence by foreign powers. They had to concede Hong Kong as an example to Britain back in 1842.
And that's why Hong Kong has all of that really complex history with it.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Which is honestly very funny because even where it was kind of rough in the beginning, yeah, the people, we were not going to get into anything with modern politics, but it's just really funny about how when Hong Kong went back to being a part of China, the people of Hong Kong were very upset about having to go and be back part of China. Anyway, the reason why they wanted to, not only the reason why, but in order to help stave this off, what they needed to do was that they needed to modernize as rapidly as possible. They needed to build up their economic strength. They needed to reinforce their military. They needed to protect themselves from invasion. And this is why many of Japan's leaders and other important government officials set off on something called the Iwakura mission. This was a journey of observation and learning to the United States and Europe just a few months after the revolutionary switch to prefecture system. The mission that they had also carried a bunch of students, and its participants would contribute greatly to the country's modernization on their return to Japan. Basically, send out a bunch of kids and potentially experts or people that would be capable of learning, learn as many foreign, not secrets, but foreign abilities and powers as you could, bring them back to Japan, and we will utilize them. Around the same time, the Meiji government also then concentrated its efforts on promoting industry and introducing modern enterprise, all to try and develop a kind of capitalism inside of Japan. One of the early stages that they had was to sweep away the old feudal system of internal checkpoints, the post stations, the merchant guilds, all these different things that could be a barrier to industrial development. They built new infrastructure. The first telegraph line was built between Tokyo and Yokohama in 1869. It was then stretched out from Nagasaki to Hokkaido only 5 years later, with an undersea line that connected Nagasaki to Shanghai then being established later after that. In 1871, they developed their own postal service that would replace the former courier system. Most post offices were then established around the country, selling stamps and postcards for fixed prices. And in 1877, Japan joined the Universal Postal Union, which linked its postal service with the rest of the world. That same year, they would start to import their first ever telephones. So mind you know how like in other countries, they're starting about going from this to this to this to this over the series of several decades?
Yeah.
Japan did all of this, jumping from like nothing to catching up, not quite, but almost to a par in what they were importing technology-wise to utilize in like 10 years.
This was the 1860s?
What, late 1860s, but it's mostly the beginning, like 1871, all the way through 1879. This is like over a period of 7 years they're doing this.
That's impressive.
Yes.
So I guess in the end, it kind of worked out positively.
Yeah.
It did.
It did. But we're also going to talk about a lot of the horrible effects that happened upon people during this time because of it.
Well, since they Walmarted the entire country, I'm assuming it didn't go well.
Well, that was the initial thing. We're talking about what Japan then did to its own people.
What do you...
also was kind of Walmarting it.
Okay. Go. I need to know. Okay.
We'll explain. But first off, more developments and positive things. They built a rail service that started in Tokyo and Yokohama in 1872. This initial route did rely on a lot of British assistance and European powers financing it, providing train cars, even engineers. In 1874, they built another line from Kobe to Osaka. That in turn was connected to Kyoto in 1877. By the turn of the century, the network of railroad that they had, mind you, this is over the course of 30 years, they managed to connect the entire country with railroad. Everywhere. The government also invested in upgrading all the country's major roads, allowing smoother transportation of goods and other vehicles. They also put huge backing behind private business. Mitsubishi, remember the company Mitsubishi, like Mitsubishi Cars? That and other companies came around during this time because Mitsubishi at this time wasn't a car company. They weren't anything like that. Do you know what they were?
A tractor company.
That's actually a good guess considering how many companies start out like that. I know. Glad you remember
that. That was my best guess.
But no, they were a shipping company.
Okay.
So they were...
How'd they get into the car business?
I mean, a lot of them developed further on. Oh, these companies that would become the Zaibatsu, they got their hands in everything. That was the gist. They didn't just do one thing. They controlled everything that they could.
What do you get when you take two childhood friends with a passion for unexplored history and a whole lot of booze?
You get the goofiest game in history, Queen's Podcast.
Hi, I'm Nathan.
And I'm Katie, and we're the hosts of Queens Podcast.
Join us while we spill the tea on women from history.
We get into all kinds of stories here, like biographies of lesser-known figures, for instance, Sayida Halytura, powerful pirate queen.
To the stories you might already know, like Marie Antoinette or Cleopatra, but with a fun twist.
Each queen is paired with a cocktail that'll totally get you in the mood to hear fun, juicy, and dramatic stories from history.
Because history is so much more than just dudes on a battlefield, and we believe that the female perspective and roles are just as deserving of their time in the spotlight.
Right. So come get to know these queens. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Cheers.
So Mitsubishi was a shipping company that at first couldn't really compete because it didn't have a lot of the modern support, but the government heavily invested in it and simultaneously gave it a bunch of privileges. Like they would subsidize it basically. So if they had to run shipping routes to a place that someone could either use a foreign ship or they could use a Japanese ship, they usually went with the foreign ship because it was cheaper. Well, the government would subsidize Mitsubishi. So the Mitsubishi, even though it should be more expensive, the government would lose money just to make sure that Mitsubishi won the contract to be able to ship. And it worked. And because of this, it grew and grew and grew and became bigger and more efficient and dominant. And it turned Mitsubishi and others into powerhouses. In the industrial sector, you saw the Shinagawa Glass Factory, the Aichi Spinning Mill, the Fukuoka Cement Works, Sapporo Brewery, which, remember, Sapporo, I'm sure you've seen it. We've seen it at bars when we go there, like the Japanese beer. Yeah, that's around this time that gets developed.
Do you know how incredibly smart you have to be to develop a country this quickly and have it function and succeed?
It's one of the reasons why it's referred to as the Japanese miracle.
That, just thinking about, you know, from like a smaller perspective, trying to restructure a business, like a company, the pushback and all of the effort it takes to get everybody on board and then everything functioning properly, working out all of the kinks, it can take years. But they did it to a country in like a decade. That is wild.
Well, that was the beginning of developments. If you want to look in terms of what they were able to do, especially after once you had the Russo-Japanese War, then we're talking about a time since that was what, 1906, I think is what that was. Yeah, 1906. So we're looking at a time period of about 30 years. Perhaps one of the most famous one of these is the Tomioka Silk Mill in Gunma Prefecture, which was built in 1872. It had 300 silk reeling machines of the latest design that were imported from France. And there was a guy, a Frenchman by the name of Paul Bernal, who headed a team of French technicians, mostly women, who would oversee operations and train Japanese workers until they would take it over. And in turn, these workers would pass on their knowledge to others across the country, which was not cheap, mind you. Do you know why this succeeded? Because they invested so heavily into their own industry. They sacrificed everything they possibly could, and they brought in as much help as they could for as short of a time as possible. They didn't want to be dependent upon foreign help, but they knew that they had to in the short term. So some 3,000 foreign specialists were brought into Japan in order to work on this stuff. More than 500 at a time present in the peak of the year of 1876. And while they were very highly skilled, their services came at a huge price. For example, I found this detail here. There was a Japanese high official by the name of Sanjo Sanetomi. He earned 800 yen each month as the Grand Minister of State. The British engineer, Thomas Kinder, received a monthly salary of 1,045 yen for his work at the Imperial Mint. So an engineer here that was a foreigner that was being brought in as a specialist was making a good 25% more than the head of state. Which is a lot. That's a lot to say. That's how much
they probably
more they
had that rule that companies put in where they're like, oh, just don't discuss your salary with anyone. Maybe they did that.
Maybe, but the rewards that they were giving to foreigners to do all this, it leveled huge amounts of investment coming to Japan. That everyone wanted in on it because it was a big way to get a whole bunch of money and do a lot of development, and it worked. Unfortunately, not everyone was pleased with what was happening. not everyone was, not everyone's lives was necessarily getting better. Namely, the samurai, of course, which had been the dominant people across society for centuries, they lost much of their place and power in it. You see, under the shogunate, the farmers in society were the main targets of taxation. They were the ones who paid for everything. Depending on the harvest, the revenues could vary greatly from year to year. There was no real consistent source of income. The Meiji government wanted to set the tax burden not on the farmers, but rather on the landowners by issuing bonds which the value of the land was written. In 1873, this made landowners responsible for paying a tax rate of 3% of the land value, which would give the government a reliable source of tax revenue that was paid in cash and not in rice. Because prior to this, being a feudal agricultural society, the way that they traded and did everything wasn't with coinage, it was rice. There were still coins, but the dominant form of thing that you traded with everything was literally rice. That's what you would utilize. So the new government starts pushing forward policies, removing the previous class system, which had divided the population into all the different groups from the samurai, the farmers, the artisans, the merchants, and establishing, to a degree, greater equality. I'm going to say that with air quotes, equality. And it then introduced a 3-year period of compulsory military service for males that were of 20 years of age. Japan's first regular army then consisted of these conscripts, which that then removed the samurai's place as they would no longer have held even a position of being in the military realm, which was their dominant thing before.
Why couldn't they just make them high-ranking military? Problem solved.
Oh, see, because that was not how you could modernize your society. You were then promoting people based off their birth and not by their actual skill.
Well, they could just be grandfathered in, just this group.
See, here's the issue. Here's the issue with it. They would much rather use the conscripts and others that they could train and mold to the exact thing that they want versus people that
were set in their ways, wouldn't want to change. They'd want to fight the way they've always fought, so they wouldn't be able to modernize.
Correct.
Okay, fine. I'll give them that. But what did they do about the samurai?
Well, the funny thing is, the samurai, prior to all of this, the way that they lived was that they lived off a stipend that was paid by the government, specifically by the government, or I say by the government. It was paid by the government, and the Meiji government took over these payments from the local governments that were paying the samurai before. The stipend was then cut off. It was reduced to a one-time payment. And then after that one-time payment, which was government bonds in 1876, it was gone entirely. So the samurai no longer had an income.
But they had no other usable skill.
Mm-hmm.
So what did they do with that entire group of people?
That they would have to relearn, they'd have to retrain, they would have to do all these different things. That's one of the things. I think I remember when we talked about the Battle of Shiroyama and the rebellion by Saigo Takamori, which we're going to mention in here. There were a number of schools that were built up by people in order to specifically try and salvage samurai and teach them some skills because they didn't really have anything else. The other thing was the use of surnames, like literally last family names. Something that was a prerogative for samurai only, that it was very important that these samurai have a family name. Now, all of a sudden, that was extended to the general population. Everyone now had a last name. Because again, that was not something that everyone had. And that was a further blow to the warrior class, but the big one was when they passed an edict that prohibited wearing swords. The very symbol of being a samurai, gone. Removal. Can't do that anymore. It's over. So for these reasons, the Meiji government started to see a series of samurai uprisings. Most seriously then in 1877, where you had the rebellion by Saigo Takamori in the Satsuma province. You had the Satsuma Rebellion. The new national army that they created went in full force, crushed it, successfully subjugating the insurgency. And that was the last military threat to the Meiji government's authority. The thing is, we talked about the samurai, the people who had been the dominant upper class in society, the ones who had really controlled things, or even if they didn't necessarily control things, the ones who were supposed to theoretically be at the top of the ladder. It wasn't just them. A lot of other people suffered too, namely the farmers. You would think that in an industrial society, that with everything developing, there would be a lot more options. People would get a lot wealthier, and that this would mean that farmers would potentially have more opportunity from possibly land reform or maybe something like that. But no. That's not how that works. In the early 1880s, the Minister of Finance, by the name of Matsukata Masayoshi, he introduced a series of deflation policies that would set the prices of agricultural products tumbling, and it would bankrupt many of the farmers. Some wealthy individuals would benefit, though, because this would allow them to buy up cheap agricultural land from those who had gone under. Remember the thing that we talked about with Rome and what would happen when the soldiers would go off to fight and then they would come back and their farm, which hadn't been worked, was now bankrupt?
Yeah.
Imagine something like that, except instead of the whole war aspect, it was, yeah, no, we just ended up fixing the prices so that it was so low that the farmers just straight up could not compete and do this. Like they couldn't do anything. So a whole bunch of farmers lost their land. The land ended up getting bought up by these groups and wealthy individuals who consolidate it and mechanize it so that they are able to actually produce a lot more food out of it. But simultaneously, the farmers who were on it before all lost their livelihoods and ended up getting herded into the cities where they have to work in factories or working as tenant farmers under landlords who are able to then reap the benefits of having all of this land and live off the work of those common people like a new type of feudal lord. So, together with these rich city merchants, these people that are acquiring all this wealth start to buy up stocks and setting up new companies. The years following the mid-1880s, like 1886, 7, 8, 9, it was a boom in establishing companies. They got established everywhere. Spinning, silk reeling, light industry is thriving everywhere. Business is booming. The privately run Osaka spinning mill, it incorporates a whole bunch of British made spinning mules. It has these huge steam powered mechanized production going. Employees are working in day and night shifts, You know how people would talk about things where it's like, oh yeah, no, back in the day and they used to work these 12 hour shifts. Well, what they would do is they would not only do 12 to 14 hour shifts, but it would be continuous so that day or night, there would be a shift that would be running. The factory would be packed out from the morning that it began all the way until the next morning. There was no end. It would produce and produce and produce. And by keeping these mills in operation 24/7, this would allow for massive production of cotton yarn every day. And in addition to that, the other thing is that the workers who are working in it, because remember, it's oftentimes a bunch of poor farmers who lost all their land and now had no livelihood and got shoved into the cities. Now they and their families and even their children had to go into the factory to produce as much as they possibly could for the equivalent of pennies. It was very, very little. As the yarn was extremely cheap to produce through this, a lot of other people were seeing the potential profits in it, and they would set up similar companies, and you started to see this everywhere. Light industry exploded throughout Japan in the late 19th century. Less than 30 years after the Meiji Restoration, it had a massive capitalist economy.
The Japanese have always worked that hard.
Yeah. Yeah. They did it in the beginning.
Wow.
One of the things they preached, I didn't put any in here, but in the beginning, there was a lot of discontent that was occurring at this time. They almost had a series of communist uprisings among people, because you can probably imagine.
Honestly,
what
I
was
would
going
have
on.
I would have communist uprised too under these working conditions.
And that was,
I get it,
one of the fears of the government going into like the early 1900s, if I recall correctly. Early 1900s, especially after the Soviet Union, I think. But either way, against all this background, the government begins to move towards drawing up a constitution. This was a pressing task for gaining Japan's international recognition as a modern state and in order to try and revise those unequal treaties. Remember we talked about before the tariffs and all that other stuff?
Yeah.
That's still there. It's been there for the entire time. They've just had to deal with that plus this the entire time. That didn't just go away. They've been at a disadvantage with foreign powers the entire time.
Wow.
And they're still doing this. Again, why it's referred to as the Japanese miracle. Because of what they were able to do. The main reason, though, as to why they are pushing ahead of this is because there's a series of popular rights movements. Remember how they were afraid of the things for communist uprisings? Well, people were also wanting more power. They demanded a national assembly. They were calling for a constitution. There was a lot of different issues that people were pushing on, and these often stressed citizen rights and democracy, while some were more radical that were influenced by the French Constitution. In contrast, the high officials within the government did not want to really change anything. They wanted to keep the power within the imperial court and factional system, but they knew that they had to do something. So they end up sending officials on a study tour of Europe to try and find the perfect government. The government that would work best for them. So their official, Ito Hirobumi, he goes on this big state tour visit looking at all these different governments. And when he comes back, he's like, okay, the one that we are going to need to use is the German model. The Prussian military system that developed into the German Empire at this point, they liked its strong emphasis on imperial power, autarky, and industrial capability. So when he returns to Japan, he makes a bunch of adaptations to their new constitution that they're drafting up in order to reflect local situations, and then submits that document to the Privy Council that's overseeing everything as an advisory body to the emperor that establishes the constitution. The Privy Council would discuss the legislation several times at meetings that were attended by Emperor Meiji before the constitution of the Empire of Japan was then officially promulgated on February 11th, 1889. And it's a funny little detail in here. They didn't just want to emphasize imperial power, Gabby. They specifically put it in the constitution that the emperor was an entity that was sacred and inviolable.
Sacred and invaluable?
Inviolable. Inviolable. Like, you could not remove the emperor without removing Japan. You cannot remove Japan without removing the emperor.
They really solidified it.
Yes. Like, it is, they doubled down on the divine aspect and the strong imperial model. At the same time, citizens were, despite this more autocratic push for it, still granted a number of rights, including freedom of religion, occupation, speech, to a degree, within the limits of the Constitution. And so it is into that setting that we come to the daughter of the samurai and why it was so important that I talk about all these things prior to it. As we said from the beginning, going into this book, when you all go and listen to it, the girl in here, Etsu, she is born in 1874 as the youngest daughter of a samurai and former daimyo, a feudal prince under the Tokugawa shogunate. Etsu grows up surrounded by all these aristocratic military ghosts of her past and her family's legacy and lineage. But because they had fought on the losing side of the war, the Boshin conflict that went and installed the Meiji Emperor, the Inagaki family ends up getting reduced in power. They end up getting weakened, though I don't want to spoil all of it, but it doesn't exactly go well for them. So everything that they had built up over the years was pretty much wiped. She's raised with all these different beliefs in their Shinto, Buddhist, samurai values. She is educated in all of these ways and the beliefs of her family. And all of that goes out the door because of changes within her family that I'm not going to spoil or reveal. And then she has to go to America. Now, I learned a whole bunch of things about Japanese history over the course of this book and folklore and all the stories that she would tell. Like at one point, there's literally the story that they end up telling about an American friend of hers that puts a set of rosary beads, like these really artistic, beautiful beads, or not beautiful beads, but it puts like this rosary set next to an intricately carved Japanese back scratcher. Like it's one of those really nice tools, like, you know, when you would buy something from a foreign shop and it's really highly decorated, maybe with porcelain and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
We're talking something like that. So she puts, her friend puts this back scratcher next to the rosary. And it's funny to her because the friend doesn't think of it. It's always not a back scratcher. This is a work of art. But to her, she's like, that's a back scratcher. What are you doing, man?
Well, art is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, I mean, the way that she likened it was that it was comparable to someone putting the Holy Bible next to a toothbrush as an art display. Like, that's what it was. Anyway, that's really the end of it all. Make sure to get the book. I think that we're done here for today. It is hot as hell in this garage right now. I looked over my wife and I see that she is suffering currently, and my voice is starting to get scratchier as time goes on. Everyone, thank you very much for listening. I ask that you get the book. You also go and check out the History of Everything podcast YouTube channel, and that you continue to listen and support us during this time. Thank you, everyone. And I will see you all next time.
Bye.